Alvin Brazil Jr. is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Brazil to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Paige Yannick, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The Execution Watch for Alvin Brazil Jr. begins.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Paige Yannick here with Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie to talk to you about the impending death of Alvin Avon Brazil, who is scheduled to be executed this evening. This is Execution Watch. I would like to tell everyone, however, that Nuestra Palabra, which is normally broadcast at this time, is being broadcast now on the HD2 channel and kpft.org. We have Linda Huhan at the death chamber in Huntsville, and is she available to speak now?
I'm here, Paige.
Hello, Linda. Has any progress been made? There was a stay requested early this afternoon.
They've got a something pending at the CCA right now, but they have not ruled on it yet.
Yes, ma'am. At the Court of Criminal Appeals, there was a stay requested by the defense attorneys based upon some allegations of bad behavior of the district attorney in Dallas County during the guilt-innocence phase of the trial, and we're going to get into that in a bit. So you have no information as to whether or not that there's a result on that yet?
No, not yet.
Okie dokie. I presume that no one has crossed the road or anything.
No, ma'am, they have not.
Okay. Well, then, thank you very much, Linda, and we're going to come back to you, and please let us know if anything else progresses.
I certainly will. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Well, the defendant, Mr. Alvin Avon Brazil, was convicted of capital murder in the year 2001 in Dallas County. This was a murder that had occurred in 1993, and Mr. Brazil was charged as a result of information that was developed through DNA testing on another offense that he committed, and it was the DNA results from the other offense were compared with the DNA results of this offense, and that is how the capital murder facts started developing. In 1993, the decedent and his 11-day-old wife, they had just been married 11 days, were walking in Mesquite, Texas by the Eastland College.
Yeah, Eastfield College.
Eastfield College. And they encountered a man who was subsequently identified as Mr. Brazil. They encountered him on a walking pathway at the college. And Mr. Brazil attempted to rob the husband. And the husband didn't have any money. And he was going to go back to the car and get his wallet out of the car to give him money. And at that point, Mr. Brazil was accused and was found guilty of shooting the husband twice. And then after he shot the husband the second time, he raped the wife. And so basically these were the facts surrounding the capital murder trial. He was accused of rape and murder during the course of rape. After the conviction, Mr. Brazil, and even during the lead up to the trial, Mr. Brazil steadfastly refused to participate with his attorneys in the formulation of his own defense. And there are interesting facts around that case that cause us to be able to talk about him tonight. Mike, would you like to talk about guilt and innocence and the things that happened during the guilt and innocence phase of the trial?
Well, the guilt and innocence was fairly clear. He killed the husband, sexually assaulted the wife. She identified him as the one who did it. They had a DNA test from him, and he got matched up with the DNA. So he was the person who did it. He was identified. There were some questions in the trial about the lineup. Was it a good lineup? Did the policeman do his job properly? But the girl was in open court and identified him. The DNA that was on her body was his DNA, so it was him. I don't think there was much question for guilt or innocence. But what you basically have is a robbery gone bad. The interesting thing about the robbery, it seems to me, and what I read about it, is when he pulled the gun on the couple, the husband immediately says, "I have no money on me, but let me go to the car and get some money."
Mm-hmm.
Well, why did he shoot him for? If it was a robbery and the guy was going to get money, why would you shoot him?
Well, at the time this offense allegedly occurred, Alvin Brazil Jr. was 18 years old. And probably an 18-year-old laborer, high school, I guess he dropped out of school at the eighth grade. There were some things about his background that might not have come out in trial, for a reason we'll talk about later, that may have explained the apparent irrational behavior of the person who did this. I mean, he was he had a pretty rough childhood. And the case didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. If you've got a young couple walking along a jogging trail, and then a gun is pulled on them, but Mike, I guess I'm concerned in terms of convicting a person. One, the identity is critical, and I think that the jury found that he was the person, but the manner in which the prosecutor identified him gives me some concerns, in that the photo array of him. The time difference between the offense and the identification. So the offense occurred in 93.
Yes, and the identification didn't occur until 7 years later.
So a lot of things could have happened out. Now, Brazil was a fairly little bitty guy, 5'6", 140 pounds. But, and the rape victim, Laura, White, you know, she said that she saw the person who came out, and he committed a sexual assault on her, but he was not identified at that point. She made, I think, a couple of sketches. The police made a couple of sketches.
There were two.
Two sketches that were made. First one, she said, that doesn't look like him at all. And the second one, for whatever reason, the sketches did not lead to his identification. So the procedure for identification, the concerns that I have, and the current concerns that were raised unsuccessfully in trial, was that he was identified, first of all, preliminarily identified by DNA. Now, DNA evidence can be contested. Just remember, I've had cases where the DNA, it could have been several different people, and that resulted in the battle of the experts. Well, one expert says it's him, and the other expert says, well, the procedures just weren't followed. Not that it wasn't him, but the procedures just weren't followed. So he might not have had a real good identification. So, and that's really why the prosecutors proceeded with an eyewitness identification, because the DNA, I don't care how factual you think it is, juries like to have somebody on the witness stand pointing and say, that's the guy right there, and they got it in this case.
Especially since there was a witness.
Yes.
You know, especially since there was a witness. The witness was living, and she ought to have been able to identify her attacker.
And the concerns I have, and that was raised unsuccessfully at trial, was how did she make the identification? That is, first of all, there was a photo array that was shown to her, and she looked at the photo array. But before the photo array was shown to her, she was told, we've identified a suspect based on DNA. So that gave her a certain level of confidence that they might have the guy. And then they showed a photo array. Now, they did go through the procedure, a good procedure, where you explain to the witness the person who committed the offense might not be there in the photo array, and you need to make sure, because we're not trying to get you to identify somebody, because it's just as important to establish innocence of people who didn't do anything as it is to establish the identification of the person who committed the offense. She viewed the array. There were some concerns about whether the complexion of all of the participants, the photos in the array might have been a little bit different. His attorney complained that it might have been suggestive in that he was darker than the other photos in the array. But in any event, she identified it.
Well, all six men in the photo array were African American.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And so the distinction was that their facial complexions were not all of the same shade.
And the concern that the defense raised is that all these guys are lighter skinned than my guy, so he's a darker guy, and you put him in there. That was a complaint. It was not successful, but it was.
But
having done that, they didn't stop there. Okay, the detective took her down to the courthouse. Okay, and he says, "Well, I didn't know that he was going to be there, but he was actually seated in the courtroom, and she saw him in the courtroom." So this is independent of the photo array. She saw him in the courtroom, and now her testimony is that I only saw the back of his head, and I'm identifying him because they have to ask that. I'm identifying the person who committed the offense, not from the photo array, not from my seeing him in the courtroom, but I'm identifying him from the person I saw on the evening of the offense. That's what I'm identifying from my own memory, and not from any kind of tainted photo array.
But here's my question to you. He was arrested 6 years after the murder. Let's assume that she was predeceased before he was arrested. Couldn't they just make the case on DNA? Did they really need an eyewitness identification?
I don't know that they could have, but I do know that in these kinds of cases, prosecutors work with suspenders and a belt. They want to make absolutely sure that we can get a conviction. Now, DNA can be attacked. And how certain they were of their DNA. I mean, because the defense had experts also to say that the DNA evidence, the procedures for presenting the DNA evidence was faulty. And if there's a doubt raised in the juror's mind, I mean, clearly we know that criminal cases are decided beyond a reasonable doubt. Then they might not have gotten the conviction. Could they have? Perhaps. But are they certain they could have? The prosecutors used every tool at their disposal to prove their cases. And particularly when it comes to capital murder cases, they really do engage in what some people might refer to as, no pun intended, overkill.
Well, and you understand why a detective would take a witness to see what a courtroom looks like.
That's what you said, yes.
Yeah, you get that. Anybody who has any experience in trials knows that putting a witness in a courtroom for the first time when they take the stand in an important case, a capital murder, could be fear-inducing. You want them to sit down in an empty courtroom. You want them to be able to be comfortable in the environment so that when they're giving their testimony, it can be more conversational and they are not shocked by the fact that, oh my God, I'm facing all these people. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Oh my God, what does this look like? You don't want that issue, those kinds of issues to arise. And I understand why the detective may wanted to have taken her to the courthouse to accustom her to the environment.
Well, you cover several things there, Paige. One, the detective, he reports he took her to the courthouse to meet with the prosecutor. Okay. And then while he's down there, he said, I just wanted to show her the courtroom so that she would not get lost on the date that she has to go down and testify. That whole witness preparation thing about making the witness comfortable and so forth, that's more of a prosecutor's job to do. So he wasn't doing all of that, but it just happened that Alvin Brazil was in court that day. Now, was it happening?
But
I don't
did know. It just happen that way?
That's his
you
testimony.
Know, I understand that's his testimony, but the truth of the matter is, if they're starting capital murder voir dire, jury selection, then the detective knows that they've started it. Everybody related to the case knows that they've started the voir dire process, and we're thinking it's going to take 4 weeks, or we're thinking it's going to take however many weeks it's going to take to select the jury, but they know it's going on.
Okay, but the detective's testimony was that he did not know that Alvin Brazil was in the courtroom that day, and he's showing her the courtroom by looking through the window of the courtroom. So it didn't go inside.
Yeah, I know.
Went through the window, and her claim is that, again, I only saw the back of his head for a few seconds.
Yeah,
and
she said 10 or 15, I believe.
But witness identification is critical in pretty much every case. If they're the witness, eyeball witness, I mean, that is probably as persuasive as anything in the criminal justice
system.
If
you don't have DNA, but if you have DNA,
yes,
pretty conclusive.
But I tend to think, and I think many other people do too, that, you know, the person who was attacked, the identification by the person who was attacked is more important to a jury than merely just the scientific evidence alone. If you have that personal identification, it rings a bell with the jury.
And we're going to get, I'm sure, get back to talking about this case, but on this point of DNA and eyeball witness identification, I'm personally aware of several cases, and I do the study would probably find this to be the case. The exonerated death row inmates, or the exoneration of people in prison, more often occurs when DNA evidence showing that this could not have been the person. That the exoneration happens more with the DNA coming back saying it could not have been the person than the eyeball witness. So juries believe eyeball witnesses. Even if it was not the person, juries tend to believe.
But you're telling me that appellate courts believe DNA, and even when witnesses testify and jurors find somebody guilty, if the DNA is wrong, they reverse themselves. Well, of course, look at DNA.
That does happen.
Yeah. Okay, okay. But let's get back to this case. Because in this case, we had both the DNA, contested testimony on DNA, that purportedly identified him, and we had an eyeball witness, okay, who said that I saw him, and after all, her claim is that the person who jumped out of the woods committed a sexual assault on me, that's the person in the courtroom today. And so that evidence was, I would imagine, pretty persuasive.
But again, what we have is a robbery with a shooting. How many robberies with shooting become death penalty cases?
Oh, now, this is prosecutorial discretion here.
Yeah,
so, yes.
I'm asking you. He has one carjacking, and it is robbery. This is not typically what we see as a death penalty case. What I'm here to claim is that it was a hate crime.
How was it a hate crime?
It's a hate crime, I think, because the man who was killed, the man who was shot, had volunteered to go get the money from his car. If it's a robbery, the guy's getting the money, why not get the money and then shoot him? He shot him before he got the money. And what I find interesting is that the victim started praying and asking God to forgive him and his wife for all that they've done. Then the defendant comes up and says, "Where's your God now?" and shoots him. I think the motivation for the shooting was the prayer by the victim to God for forgiveness. I don't think he intended to shoot the victims. I think it became a hate crime when he hated the person praying.
One of the issues that the press has sort of picked up on is that evidence of Alvin Brazil's mental state, mental deficiencies, was not entered. Was not evidence in the court. There was not a sufficient showing. The press seems to think not a sufficient showing of mitigation as a result of his mental deficiencies, and that's an issue that's raised, and that's one that's pretty interesting in this case, as far as I'm
yes,
concerned.
It really is, because it seems that he may have had, excuse me, he may have had some limited psychological capacity. He had had an IQ, a kind of IQ exam when he was 22 years old that suggested he'd scored 75. Now, generally, we perceive competency to stand trial and ability to be a defendant to be 70. But in this case, the doctor on appeal, actually in the habeas, thought that it could have gone as low as 5 points lower. And unfortunately, Mr. Brazil decided he was not going to participate in a true intelligence quotient Winchler test. And he decided a lot of things in his trial in chief that went against the very best nature of his attorney to help defend him in his case.
If he would have cooperated with his lawyer was ready to trot out the old argument that he had abusive upbringing, his family history was mental illness, not that he was mentally ill, but his mental illness in his family, and he had a head injury. How does a head injury and somebody in your family have a mental illness mean anything to this case to mitigate damages?
Well, a childhood head injury could prevent the child from developing as well or as completely in all the stages of growing up. I know one child that had a head injury at the age of 8 months, and that child eventually became, a fully functioning adult.
But the lawyer did not need cooperation to bring that. He could have got the medical records and brought it up on his own, and he didn't. So I'm saying maybe there was no head injury.
Well,
couldn't he have brought it up without the client's permission?
The client wouldn't even participate.
Why would he have to participate if the lawyer's got medical records to show he had a head injury and psychological?
How are you going to get the evidence in front of the jury unless the doctor has examined him?
Well, if he had a head injury, then the head injury is already in the past in his medical record. There's a head injury.
Who's going to testify about it?
Well, you don't need
the defendant is going to refuse to testify.
You have the medical records that show a head injury, and then you can bring in an expert to talk about head injuries can cause mental problems.
Okay, and the thing is, the experts have to be provided some information. Now, in this case, clearly, since it is a death penalty case, mitigation is critical. And this lawyer who tried the case, the issues raised that, well, you didn't bring up the evidence of him and the four different things that they were that habeas counsel was focused on was that Brazil had a poor educational work history that was not presented, that Brazil suffered a head injury as a child resulting in being hospitalized, that he was physically abused by his stepfather, and that there was a history of mental illness in his family. Okay, now these are things that the lawyer sought to develop and sought assistance from Brazil and his family to help him and his experts develop these issues. And could he have presented those without his assistance? The argument can certainly be made. Okay, but in order for him to try to get back into court, he raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. And under the Strickland test, the ineffective assistance of counsel, and what this lawyer did on this issue was substantially subpar performance. And his deficient performance prejudiced the defendant, saying that it would have made a difference.
Yet these issues are the same issues that are brought up in almost every capital case. Abusive upbringing, mental illness in the family, head injuries, these are almost a template for appeals of death penalty cases.
So you're saying that even without Brazil's participation, the lawyer should have presented these issues?
I'm saying I think the lawyer said these things because that's what you said. I still think that he should have produced some evidence of these things to present to the case, and he didn't. I don't know why you'd even mention unless you have evidence to bring. I don't think he needed the client's cooperation. And let me ask you, are these three issues any issues that should excuse somebody from the death penalty?
That's the second prong of the Strickland test. And I don't know if it would have made a difference.
I don't either.
In the case that I've seen, I don't see it making a difference either. So we're talking about things that are moot points.
Angels on the heads of pins.
I think of all the cases we've had, without making a comment on Mr. Brazil, it just seems to be an alarming lack of criminal history, alarming lack of lawyers doing anything to help him. I think you're right, it's prosecutional decisions to make to execute this guy, maybe because of it was a religious school, I'm assuming? It was a chiropractor school he was at, the kids with people at.
No, the school is like a community college.
But it's a chiropractor school.
Okay. I have no idea.
That's what I read.
I don't know.
But Michael, you know that trials just have a whole lot of moving parts. And there's got to be some focus. Now, the lawyer who tried this case, he was appointed. He was qualified. He tried death penalty cases before. He used a qualified investigator to help him develop the facts of the case. Now Brazil raises the question, well, he didn't seek funds for a mental health expert to help him develop the case. And that is a point, but habeas counsel raises this point, but the fact is habeas counsel didn't either. did not seek funds to hire a mental health expert to pursue the remedy of perhaps saving his life as a result of providing mitigating evidence.
Which one of the lawyers was the one who requested $9,000 for the mental health expert? I thought that was the trial counsel. Am I incorrect on that?
I don't know, Paige. I just don't know that.
Do either one of you people think this would be a capital case in Harris County?
Yes.
You think so?
Very likely.
Okay.
It's not the worst kind of capital case, but it's eligible.
It's clearly eligible for the death penalty. It's just a robbery and a killing.
And whether you pursue the death penalty or not, I mean, this is one that discretion could have gone either way. I mean, this is a robbery. This is a killing followed by a sexual assault that does not elevate it at all, but I don't see, we've been talking about mitigation a lot. Now the future danger, which is the flip side of that, I guess the fact that Brazil, after having the jury find that he committed the offense, he then is identified by having committed a sexual assault of a child. And that sexual assault of a child case, I think the two sexual assault cases raises the issue with the jury as to what do we do with this guy now? And if they're thinking, what do we do with this guy now? As Jim Skelton used to like to say, if they're trying to figure out what do they do with the guy now, then how strongly do you want to make the argument that he's mentally deficient? Because you might not be able to fix that.
And what does it tell you that he got 5 years for sexually assaulting a child?
Well,
was it really a child or was it a teenager?
It was a 15-year-old teenager, okay. And he had gotten probation
for
originally.
That.
And then once his probation was revoked, that's when, excuse me, that's when he got the 5 years on the sexual assault for a violation of the probation.
Can't be that much of a serious sexual assault then to get a probation and get 5 years and be revoked.
Well, remember that the sexual assault of the 15-year-old occurred prior to this capital murder. And he got put on probation for that one. And he didn't have a previous conviction.
Does it make sense that maybe it was statutory rape with a girlfriend? He was in his early 20s.
He was in
15.
His early 20s and she was 15. God only knows.
So are we, painting him out as being a rapist for raping two women? When the reality is the first one might be statutory, and even this lady, he tried to shoot her first, not rape her. He tried to shoot her, and the gun malfunctioned.
Well, after he had shot the husband,
yeah.
He tried to shoot her.
Yeah, and the gun malfunctioned.
And that's when the gun malfunctioned.
And I've heard two stories. I've heard he raped her, and I've heard he sexually assaulted her. I'm assuming sexual assault her means rape. But I've not been clear, did he...
There's no such thing as rape in Texas. The term for rape in Texas
is
referred to as sexual assault. So that's what the statute calls it. Now we've got the other issue of that issue regarding the request for withdrawal of the stay of execution.
Oh yes, and this is the most intriguing thing that is going on right now. At the time of guilt and innocence, the prosecutor went ahead and made a comment to his co-counsel on the issue of identification of the husband's body. And prior to the identification of the husband's body, he looked at his co-counsel and reportedly said, "Watch this." And then he shows an autopsy photo to the wife of her husband, and she loses it in open court. And she goes, "Oh my God, I can't believe you did that."
She jumps all over the prosecutor.
And they have to declare a delay in the trial and take her outside. Her sobs are heard ringing through the hallway outside the courtroom. The jury is excused from the court. And then...
You know, we kill people in this country, but then we go so far as to go overboard in saying how you will and will not behave inside a courtroom. So the problem here was that that Laura White made an emotional outburst in the court, okay, attacking the prosecutor, saying, I can't believe you did that, and sobbing and crying, and you could hear outside and everything. Defense counsel moved for a mistrial.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you guys know, those kinds of things just can't happen in court.
Yeah.
And the moving for the mistrial was on the basis that not only was there an emotional outburst, but that the prosecutor set it up. The prosecutor is the one who intentionally caused her to do that. And she later on says, well, you know, he did tell me he was going to show me the photo, but I just reacted.
I reacted badly.
And so the,
and I'm sorry.
But the motion for mistrial was
denied.
So after the motion for mistrial is denied today, okay, that was the basis for the defendant's motion to withdraw the execution date, because the prosecutor says, look, I did not know she was going to react like that. I mean, if I knew she was going to react like that, there's no way I would have done anything about it. But I prepared her. She admits that I prepared her. But I didn't know it was going to happen like that. Well, co-counsel says, some as reported as having said before the photo was introduced, lead counsel for the prosecutor says, watch this. What does that mean? Does it mean, watch this, I'm going to cause this emotional outburst? Or does it mean, watch this, I'm going to instruct you, second chair, on how best to introduce this kind of evidence in a court? That is, the autopsy photos have to be used, to some extent, to show mode and means of the death. And so the prosecutor has to do this. He has to do that in some manner, and that is the witness can see that the injuries were consistent with her testimony. Now, I don't know if the defendant's motion to withdraw the execution date was successful or not, because we don't know why the prosecutor said, we don't know whether he even said, watch this. We don't know what watch this means. We don't have any clue at all, and the defense says we don't either. But since we found this out today, Judge, what harm could it do? The man's gonna, if he's going to die, delaying it's not gonna change anything. So give us some time to conduct depositions and find out, did the prosecutor intentionally goad his witness into that emotional outburst? Because if he did, then the defense's motion for a new trial, mistrial, should have been sustained.
And it turns out that David Dow and his co-counsel on this appeal, to withdraw the execution date, have attempted and are in the process of attempting to get an affidavit from the co-counsel at the trial, Mr. D'Amato, Tom DeMore, excuse me. And nobody has crossed the road yet. And at 5:30, they hadn't yet gotten an affidavit from Mr. D'Amore, the co-counsel in the Capitol. And so we're still in this holding pattern, waiting to see what the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to do.
And does anybody think that if for some reason they gave him a new trial, anything would be different?
I do.
Well, it'd be different.
Guilt or innocence or in terms of punishment?
Well,
I was just thinking that it'd be much different in terms of participants. The lead counsel, Mr. West, is not going to try it again. If he's accused of intentionally provoking a witness on the stand and they cause a stay in an execution, I don't imagine if Mr. West is still living that he will end up being the lead counsel in a second trial. And whether or not Mr. DeMore is involved in it, after all this time, I tend to think that the Dallas County Attorney's Office would want to get new people on it.
And as a defense lawyer, my feeling is if whenever you get another shot, take it. Here's a man who's getting ready to die tonight. So if we can delay that and maybe even give him another shot. I mean, the other thing is, you know, we in this country, I mean, I have some difficulty with the way the death penalty is applied, but the amount of due process we have under our Constitution, we take these matters very seriously. We take all criminal matters very seriously. And I think we need to commend ourselves as a nation for how good a job we do. I mean, other countries, you know, off with his head, and then that means off with his head. But we're given due process, and the courts take a long look, a serious look at what are we doing in every case, but particularly where somebody's life is taken.
And in the case of capital cases, there is not only the automatic appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, but then also there's the habeas procedure, and there's a habeas in the state court, and then there are habei beyond number in the federal courts.
And the thing is that the procedure going from the automatic appeal to the Texas, and then the collateral, as Paige mentioned, the habeas procedures, where they have a chance of in the direct appeal
righting a wrong if it occurred,
if there's a constitutional violation, that's primarily what they're looking for in the collateral procedures. And typically the issues like ineffective assistance of counsel, the facts are not even known well enough to even develop a good argument for ineffective assistance of counsel until some time has passed, not with the direct appeal, but with at least the state habeas, collateral procedure. But this ineffective assistance of counsel, you know, the two prong test, I mean, the substantially subpar performance, I mean, the listeners might be interested to know that courts have found that if the lawyer is totally drunk during the cross-examination of witnesses, that's not necessarily ineffective, because the second prong has to be applied, and that is what it made a difference. So lawyers have fallen asleep in court.
Yes,
not necessarily.
Indeed, that did happen.
Not by itself. But at least the procedure is there. The procedure is there to take a look. And I commend our system, on the very date that that Alvin Brazil is scheduled to be executed, the appellate lawyer finds out that the second chair prosecutor, is reported to have said that lead prosecutor says, watch this, right before supposedly eliciting the emotional outburst that resulted in a request for a mistrial. If that mistrial should have been granted, and it is belatedly granted now, he gets a new trial. And that's the effort that's being made now to save a man's life.
It was drawn to my attention that I used a term that we use all the time and regular listeners are familiar with. When I say cross the road, witnesses to an execution will cross the road into the Walls unit from across the street in a reception area. And it does not appear that in this case yet anyone has crossed the road. Under Texas law, he can be executed any time between the hours of 6 p.m. and 11:58, pretty much, 11:59. But after that, he would have to have a new execution date set.
And also the execution has to
be completed.
Be completed by that time.
Yeah.
So it's got to be initiated well before the 11th hour.
Correct.
It's got to be started much earlier than that. And so any delay on the defense side of getting another shot is, you know, you live to fight another day.
Literally.
Absolutely.
It's funny, but all these issues we're talking about has nothing to do with Mr. Brazil. It's testing the waters for the next execution, the next defendant. We're always doing this for the cases in the future. He's a test case for the next case like this.
I'm not sure I understand that, Michael. Could you explain a little bit more?
We're talking about issues, but these issues are not designed to save him. They're designed to make issues for the next person who's going to be executed to protect his rights.
Well, in this case, a stay would save him.
It is true. It would save him. But we still do this not for this man. We do it for the next person to be executed. And even the lawyers who do the appeal, they are doing it to make the law right in terms of execution.
Well, but isn't our entire judicial system built upon the theory that it's going to be reliable and it's going to be fair and it's going to be just? All of those grade school virtues that we indulge, we rely upon that. And that is what our appeals are about. Was it just? Did we do right in punishing the defendant in getting to that point? How we do it is important as what we do.
And also, Michael, it appears that we've got a system. We say we've got a system of laws, not of men. And in each one of these cases, the case involves applying the law to the facts in this case. So what we're talking about right now, tonight, has to do with Alvin Avon Brazil Jr., and how do our laws apply to him? Not for the last case, not for the next case, but for this case. Now, do cases have precedential impact? Sure, they do. But all focus right now is on him. You know, did he have an effective counsel? Was he mentally deficient? Should that have been presented to the court? And if the failure of presenting that mitigating evidence, if it were mitigating, because sometimes being deficient mentally might not be all that mitigating, and the lawyers are allowed to have a certain level of trial strategy. The lawyers might not have. We raised the question earlier about trial counsel. Could he have presented the mental health information in the absence of Brazil's cooperation? Could he have? Sure, he could have. Did he have to? What was his strategy in that case for not presenting without Brazil's assistance?
Well, and it appears from all of the cases taken together concerning Mr. Brazil that his trial attorney attempted to find other family members who were willing to come and testify about Mr. Brazil's whatever mental deficiencies might have been. And all of them ended up basically turning him down, turning the lead trial counsel down in spades, and sometimes with bad words.
On that note, there was one reference that one Brazil's sister,
yes,
was asked to come and cooperate, and she indicated that if she got on the witness stand, she told the in the punishment stage, she told the jury they were a bunch of jerks. So that would not have helped. But when you run across that, you say, what am I supposed to do? Or more particularly, do I have to, is it going to, and we all ask these questions before presenting any kind of, we should, presenting anything to a jury. Is it going to help my client? or more particularly, is going to hurt.
Is it in fact going to hurt them? Nobody in his family cared about coming to court and testifying on his behalf?
Does anybody think that he set out that day to rob and kill these people, or did he set out to rob them?
Well, he went with a gun, so we know he intended to commit an aggravated robbery. Did he intend to commit the murder? Well, whether or not he intended to commit the murder at the very start of it is not material to the issue. If he intends to commit the aggravated robbery by carrying the gun and robbing people on the jogging path, and a foreseeable result of committing aggravated robbery and firing the weapon ends up in murder.
Murder, but not capital.
Well, it's capital
because it's coupled with the aggravated robbery.
As Paige pointed out, Michael, this is really the definition of capital murder. The intent is not necessarily to commit the murder. That's the way our statute reads. So Paige pretty much paraphrased the statute regarding the issue of intent.
So, and I think I know the answer to this, but if I intend to rob you, not shoot you, just rob you, in the process of robbing you, you say something that gets me mad, and so I shoot you. There's not a distinction between me going out to rob you.
You've committed aggravated robbery and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
But we're talking about mitigating circumstances. If my intention wasn't to hurt you, but hearing you say things that I didn't like, now I'd shoot you. I didn't intend to shoot you. I intended to rob you. My temper got the best of me, and I shot you.
But you went with the gun with the intent of using it as a power play. I mean, your intent to use the gun is firmly established by your picking up the gun.
Doesn't that have to do with future dangerousness? Was he out there trying to hurt people, or was he out there trying to rob people? And the other thing, I don't see much future dangerousness with this guy.
Well, and Jim Skelton used to point out that in our capital murder structure, you don't have the defense of can't think of what that defense is. When a person gets angry, he says something McCain that interferes with it. Sudden passion. Okay, sudden passion is not available in capital murder. So it might be mitigating, but it does not apply to the issue of guilt.
But does it apply to the issue of future dangerousness?
Yes, mitigation of future dangerousness, yes. They do work hand in hand.
It's still capital murder. Yeah, but it
should
have been brought up as a mitigation for future dangerousness.
Oh, and should have been brought up. It should have been brought up is specifically why we want another shot. You know, from a defense standpoint, you know, once you've taken the exam the first time, and they give you a shot at the second time.
I can do it so much better the next time.
What I could have done. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, we still have no reports from Huntsville. And that leads us to conclude at 6:54 that at least someone is considering the motion for stay.
That appears to be the only issue on the table.
Yeah.
Right
now.
We have no idea whether an execution will occur tonight. It may or may not occur. But we always have this program, as our listeners know. We've gone through a few staff changes, but as our listeners know, whenever there's an execution in Texas, mm-hmm. we show up here and we do a show.
So,
has anybody heard from Linda?
But if this case is tried again,
it's still pending.
Okay.
So,
as our producer just said at the door, the case is still pending. So no, we haven't heard from Linda.
So since the case is still pending, there's no point in us talking about what happened. So if he were executed,
just theoretically, last show we talked about there's only 7 more drugs left for doing executions. So, assuming that's all there is, if he gets a stay tonight, is that going to be the matter of life or death on him, that he's now going to be put lower down on the list, and by the time he gets up again, there'll be no more poison?
Well, the state of Texas has gone to a compounding pharmacy, actually two compounding pharmacies, in order to come up with the pentobarbital for executions. So I don't know whether or not to predict that running out of the drug by exhausting the six more doses they have left would be sufficient to delay execution.
Be interesting.
These are pharmaceuticals, and, you know, they can make more. Unfortunately, they can make more, or they can use others if they get them approved. So we're dealing with the state of Texas, who legally the execution of the death sentence can be carried out, and so long as it can be carried out, I suspect that they'll continue to be so.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brazil is still alive, and we have yet to know what will happen. Thank you for listening, and our good wishes to you and to all who care.